Everyone, thank you for coming to our panel nice and early on Saturday morning. We're titled Diving Deeper, The Untold Stories of Ocean Science. I'm really excited to have an awesome crew here today. We've got three scientists who study things underwater and in the water. Where those of us who are total land lovers can't see. We lost, unfortunately, one panelist, Amal, who is a journalist. So I'm going to jump in and do some talking instead. So at the very end of this table, I'm going to do a quick intro for the panelists, and then they'll talk about what they do. I'm not going to read all the long bios. I'm just going to do quick and easy. And if you want to read more, they are all on Hoowa. So at the end of this very table, there's Dr. Hu Liu, who is associate professor, the Department of Marine Biology. Of Texas A&M University at Galveston. His research focuses on extreme events and what these extreme events like hurricanes do to the ocean and the estuaries that we can't see from where we are and why it's important. That type of research has taken him all over the world, it seems. He had conducted his research in the Gulf of Mexico, Gulf of Alaska, Yellow Sea, and the Arabian Gulf. Man, I want that job. But, of course, I would never get to the point of having a PhD, so forget about it. Next to him is Fernanda Gutierrez Calderon. He's a passionate marine biologist from Mexico. He's been a cave diver since 2011, and he's been studying underwater caves since then. He's currently a PhD candidate at Texas A&M University at Galveston, and he co-authored seven scientific publications and a book chapter, including the description of seven new species of marine sponges. And he also documented some of the die-offs in some of them, so I'm curious to hear about that. Right next to me is Chris Clapp. He's joining us from Ocean Sewage Alliance. And before that, he was at Nature Conservancy, where he spent, because I'm in New York City. At Nature Conservancy, Chris focused on water quality, and at Ocean Sewage Alliance, his goal, and it's a very ambitious one, is to end wastewater pollution in coastal waters. And I am Lina Zeldovich. I'm a New York City-based freelance journalist, health, waste, and robots, because I have a background in robotics, relationship between humans and their environment. Now I'm going to turn to my panelists and ask them, what do you do and why it's important? Give us sort of a brief intro, and then we'll dive deeper. Who do you want to start?
Okay. In general, I call myself as an oceanographer, a biological oceanographer. I study marine living resources in the ocean in terms of I'm studying marine to do prediction to provide some information to the agencies, the policymakers to do early action.
And why it's important?
Why should
general public know? What should we know?
So most of the species they are ecologically or commercially important, such as oyster, jellyfish, and reef fish in the Gulf of Mexico. So this is directly related to our biology.
Hi, good morning. So I am Fernando. I am working on underwater caves. So I like to describe myself as a underwater cave ecologist. So that means that I need actually two different careers for this. I need to be a marine biologist, a set of skills inside of diving, like most of the people love diving, but will never go into a cave. For a lot of reasons. And because of this science is actually very new. So to give you an idea, it has been done only since late 80s. So for biology, it's like quite recent. Because of this, most of the things that we see inside of caves are new in all the senses. Like we are just starting to understand how climate change is affecting them, how pollution is affecting them. 90% of the species that we see there are still undiscovered. So we literally go diving there, and then we can go like 190 feet underwater. So like the size of some like small buildings. And it is really important because these underwater caves have all the flood habitats, so like in Florida, most of the water is underground. And but also we have a lot of species that are living in a single cave. So because of that, if something happened to a cave, that's the end of an entire species. And in some cases, the end of more than one species.
Okay.
Good morning, all. Happy to be here. Thank you, Lena, for reaching out. So as Lena mentioned, I'm a marine scientist by trade, or by education, rather. But more in the last decade or so, kind of a science and policy advisor by trade, where I find myself at the intersection of translating science into policy. I go out and look to practices and technologies available that could solve the problem at a given time, and then bring those to the policymakers as well. And so, you know, whereas previous to that, I was working in and under the waters all around Long Island and New England on shellfish and seagrass restoration projects. The data from those, there's a lot of partnership and teamwork involved in all of this, right around 2010 or so, there was a kind of a convergence of data from multiple disciplines, from people studying salt marshes, shellfish, terrapins, and seagrasses, that data, concurrently going on, was pointing to the source of the problem hindering the restoration attempts at those species. And so it was either close shop and give up, or find a solution to the problem. And that's what led me down the path of working on wastewater in our coastal environments.
So I am a total landlubber. I was. So I found my path to telling ocean stories in a funky kind of way. I grew up on my grandfather's farm that he managed with some interesting methods. So every fall he would open our septic tank and transfer its content into big compost pits. And then for the next 3 years, and when he would open it again in the spring, it would be just dirt, this rich black garden dirt, which is awesome and smelled so good, like the forest floor, not like sewage. So I thought that the ocean for the Hakai magazine, which some of you might know. I left my editorial job at the time, and they were just starting. I pitched them a story before they were up, and I continued writing for them. So for me, the land is to leave the land, ideally, and definitely not supposed to flow into the sea, even if it's treated, because there are still problems with that. So I found this. I would like to ask all of my panelists to get a little bit deeper and in details about what they do, why the general public should know, what stories there might be. So, Fernanda, how do you feel like being the first one? Can I put you on the spot?
Okay, so first I will take you into the cave.
Yes.
So these are very dark places. And because of that, there is no photosynthesis, a lot of people will be, there is no plants, no food, no life. Done. It's because there is no photosynthesis, they are very clean water, you will see it is so transparent that even on your light you will not see any particle, you just feel it flying. But then there is the second very interesting part. Fresh water and marine water do not mix. The density of both waters is different enough that they just form a layer, just like if you have water and oil. So you have this really interesting setting where you have some fauna living just in the fresh water, others living in the marine water, and there are others that truly is really surprising that they are just like moving across. So it's like when you are starting to look at this, like it is like, okay, how can they be living in an area where there is not productivity, like there is not like all of this energy from the sun, from the synthesis and everything. So these environments depend from everything that is coming to the cave, from everything that is outside. So I usually dive in the cenotes, that are sinkholes in the Yucatan Peninsula. Sinkholes are just like windows. Look at how many windows are in Houston, you will not be able to tell how many buildings they are. It is the same in the case of the caves. Like there are some caves that are so once you are, the cave is there, but we do not have a way to access it. So once you are like starting to get this picture, it's like, okay, then we have the cave, I'm feeling everything. And then like this division between the fresh water and the marine groundwater layer, it is called the haloplane. Top moves. Everything goes from the top, moves with this haloplane, and the haloplane is just like delivering the food into the marine groundwater layer. So it is really interesting to see those areas that do not have the haloplane, both the number of species, but also the densities, drops. So as you can see, these are very particular environments. They are very different than what we are used to, so they are considered extreme environments. And because of these conditions, like all the fauna that we can see there is really specialized. Most of them are white, most of them are eyeless, so they will have like very strong sensorial mechanisms so they can feel if there is prey, if there is food, or what it is around. But also because of this, they tend to have very small population sizes. Again, there is not a lot of food, so if I cannot eat a lot, I cannot reproduce a lot. So just to give you an example, for one of the sea stars that were discovered just 11 years ago, I did the population estimation. There are less than 300 individuals. That's the entire species. It is not listed on any risk list, like IUCN, the Red List, or anyone, because we just learn about it. But when we look at the characteristics, living in a single cave, so it is a very small region, and then less than 300 individuals, it will be listed as in the top of most of the extinction risk list. And this is the case for something that we just discovered. There is a lot of species that we are still trying to find. So like right now, literally, I have 20 species that I already know that they need to be described. And the more we dive into both looking with the morphology, but also like the genetics, the more and more species that we can see. So it is important to allow us to go further into ecological questions that are almost impossible in other areas. And actually now it's being proposed also as a proxy to do studies in other planets, particularly with the case of bacteria, because we have like an extreme environment, it is simple, so there is like, okay, if you are in an exposed planet, caves are always like not exposed like to all the radiation and everything, so like probably if we find life, we will have also better chances to understand what we need to look for evidence of life in other planets. So it is really exciting, like literally everything you want to do in a cave is going to be new. But at the same time, it is like, okay, how do I talk about conservation when most of the species are not described? How I talk about conservation is difficult both to study, but also so that people is not aware that it is there. So I have literally been on the management office in some of the areas that I use, they will be like, oh, and it's like, no, that's a 10 kilometers long cave. And the road is used above it. And in some cases, the ceiling is less than 1 meter thick. So You can imagine, like, this is, like, really amazing, really exciting, because everything is there to discover. But at the same time, it is like, okay, we truly need to make everyone aware of this very fragile ecosystem that is providing us with fresh water, because all the fresh water in the whole Yucatan Peninsula and in a lot of other areas is completely underground. And then with that even like, so right now, to be able to understand the evolution of the fauna in general, we will be missing a very important link if we do not consider...
That sounds awesome. I mean, the fact that you can hear the traffic while you're in there, what you do, mind-boggling. All right. Do you want to tell us what you do? As a short kind of like a recap, we think of hurricanes. When we think of hurricanes, we typically think of our own safety, about the destructions they do here on Earth and the recovery that we must do afterwards. So can you tell us about what you do, what you see, what your work found, how these ecosystems recover or maybe don't recover?
This is a bigger question. I can try to say this in a few minutes.
I know.
So hurricane, everybody kind of don't like hurricane here, especially living in the Gulf region. We are going to hurricane season again. So hurricane, the impact of hurricane from science part, from my perspective, I consider two important, just like Hurricane Harvey did a few years ago. Another one is a kind of strong wind, wind speed, damage caused by wind. So, sometimes when we link this to the coastal ecosystem, we call the storm surge plus rainfall. There's two different I consider two different major impact from hurricane. So when I started the project a few years ago after hurricane Harvey, what I consider these two impact. So I used historical data to collect a few 10 years ago after another hurricane called Ike in 2008. And the data we collect before and after Hurricane Harvey. This project funded by National Science Foundation, just after Hurricane Harvey. So the Ike impact, the major impact of Ike is so the Hurricane Harvey is a kind of slow-moving system. They made a landfall in stay here for a few days, dumping water here. That made the Gulf Bay kind of like a freshwater lake. After hurricane, we went to the bay, did something. The salinity is very low, just like freshwater lake. That's two different impacts I consider. Then I use data and compare the historical data with this data. We found the purpose we wanted to examine was the near term, or a chronic impact of a hurricane to the system. So we focus on some indicator we call the ecosystem indicator. We select a zooplankton as a sensitive indicator because it loses the environment temperature quickly, so they can respond to the environment change quick, transported by water to where. So we use this feature consider environmental factors such as temperature, salinity, juvenile fish. And we want to link this higher tropical level. Sorry, I see higher tropical level mean a little bit higher along the food chain. So they eat zooplankton eat phytoplankton. So our major funding is that zooplankton tend to be immediately affected by the physical action from hurricane, such as a flood. The flood leaves the living resource or organism invade to the open water, to the Gulf Coast. So the storm surge, actually they do it the other way. They pump the coastal salt water into the bay. So they can actually bring other visit to the impact of the fish. So we found that those can be a good indicator for the ecosystem resilience. They show a little bit fast recovery after the system because of their large life cycle. Life span is short, just a few months, couple months, for one generation. A lot of fish, I mean, they are important to affect the survival of big fish. They show two different response to the impact of flood and storm surge. So I can make this more clear. The flood, they flush the organism from the bay to the open water. They suddenly reduce the number of species and the density of the plankton leaving the bay. For storm surge, they pump from the transport more coastal water into the bay. Actually, they bring more coastal species into the bay. Can increase the number of species. So that's the two different ways. That's the major finding. We didn't see any, obvious impact on fish. So that's different from other research, they did in Chesapeake Bay, and there's a Palm Lake Bay in North Carolina, some in North Carolina. A little bit different. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Chris?
Did you say you did not see any adverse impact on fish?
I said, based on the data we have, we didn't see significant change for the fish density. Before, after a hurricane
Harvey. I'd like to just close your eyes for a second and imagine you're on the Great Plains sometime in the 1800s, pre-frontier agriculture. Maybe you see a small farmhouse, you see some wildflowers and grasses, blowing in the stiff plain breezes, butterflies and bees migrating from flower to flower. Maybe there's a groundhog hopping nearby and a herd of buffalo in the distance. Now, I'm going to take you underwater, somewhere on the mid-Atlantic coast, and you're in a dense bed of bright green grass. This grass is eelgrass. And on those blades of grass, you see baby scallops clinging to avoid predators on the bottom. You see tiny little amphipods going from flower to flower of these grasses, pollinating them, ensuring their survival for the next generation. You see mummy chugs and silver sides and baby flounders and seahorses. Now, hill and plow agriculture. And not long after that, you have the Great Dust Bowl. Now, on the mid-Atlantic coast, introduced several million people to the watershed, most of whom are still on cesspools and septic systems, their waste going directly into the ground, migrating from the groundwater into the bays, and now you no longer have eelgrass. That's not the future I'm hoping for, but that's the future we're heading towards. So the confluence of rising temperatures, which are rising exponentially faster in the inland waters than they are in the open ocean. The ocean acidification that comes with that is exponentially faster in the estuaries than it is in the open ocean, because within the estuaries, you also have the contribution of pollutants, mainly nitrogen and phosphorus, from a range of sources, mostly people, And that drives eutrophication. Eutrophication is when you have imbalance of nutrients or excess nutrients in your water column, which creates more algae, which then when they settle out, they decompose, creates lower dissolved oxygen levels, and decreases the pH. Exceptionally challenging if you're someone who relies upon a shell to survive. So it makes it really difficult for aquaculturists to grow more oysters. It makes it really difficult for shellfish such as crabs and scallops and other creatures that live in those ecosystems to grow their shells quick enough to avoid predation, and so on and so forth. So a lot of the conversation earlier in this conference is the ocean, right? So it's the big, gigantic ocean covers three-quarters of the surface of the Earth. But and I felt Dr. Ballard's comments really impactful because he talked about where the impact is happening. It's on the coasts and estuaries and the interconnectedness of the watersheds where people live, work, and as well as in those coastal water bodies that provide those habitats. 2/3 to 3/4 of our commercially caught fish stocks, all of our recreationally caught fish stocks, in some way, shape, or form are connected. Was just mentioned how important those coastal habitats are for protecting us from sea level rise and storm surge and the daily change in the weather patterns causing in more frequent or episodic weather events that we used to not see. So, you know, what do we do, right? So when I first started working in the water, I was working on the largest shellfish restoration project at its time. This was 2003, 2004. And I was working on a piece of underwater piece of property that was a colonial patent that had made its way into the hands of the Blue Point Oyster Company, which then the First Republic Bank eventually became the parent of, and they divested, so they handed the underwater land over to the Nature Conservancy. And at the time, we were told the only thing we could do to improve the health of that coastal embayment was to plant more heart clams because they filter water and they will help push the shift back to a system that has clearer water, able to sustain more life. What we didn't expect to see was we actually got a massive recruitment event of baby clams, right? So, you know, at one quick moment, or over a couple of years period, planting millions of, you know, spawners, adult hard clams, we saw a massive recruitment event. We thought, well, this is great. You know, we just worked ourselves out of a job. And we'll move on. However, the brown tide, which is a hunting force, that same year that we detected those billions of baby hard clams, and everything died. Everything. So we said, okay, how did that happen? And that's when a foundational piece of research that we did, along with Ivan Belliot's group out of Woods Hole, looking at the watershed, and they said, well, you have this enormous load of nitrogen coming in via the groundwater underneath the embayments, fueling these harmful algal blooms. And so, okay, well, where is that nitrogen coming from? 70% of that nitrogen was coming from cesspools and septic systems. Right, so the conventional knowledge up till that point was your water pollution problems are stormwater runoff. It's stormwater runoff. So all these municipalities had these municipal separate stormwater programs, the MS4 program, spending millions of dollars to comply with street sweeping and et cetera, et cetera, and stormwater catch basins and. We were ignoring this massive load. We had no idea that, you know, on Long Island, right, a massive suburb of New York City, that the majority of the population relied upon a hole in the ground to treat their wastewater. So you could imagine a time lag, right? So groundwater moves pretty slow, about a foot a day, both vertically and horizontally. So that you have population boom leading up into the 1970s, from the post-war era up until the 1970s. And then you see that your massive ecosystem decline starting in the late 80s or mid-80s. And so you could almost get of these harmful algal blooms and the decline of your shell fisheries. So the embayment I was working in, the Great South Bay, put out half of the nation's hard clams. Right, if you ever ate a clam on a half shell or had clam chowder somewhere, chances are, in the 1980s, chances are it came from the Great South Bay. If you ever ate a bay scallop in the 1980s, chances are it came from the Peconic Bay. Peconic Bay scallops were famous at the time. And so half of the nation's bay scallops came out of the Peconic estuary. The hard clam fishery employed 6,500 people. Just on the water, not to mention the people building boats and rakes and other gear and driving trucks and storage packing houses. And this says nothing about what happened to the actual the world famous Blue Point oyster, which had disappeared by the 1930s. So, you know, obviously that fishing pressure wasn't sustainable, but there was this compounding impact of the watershed, the pressure from the watershed and what we're putting on and into the ground, as well as what we were doing in the water that drove these fisheries to their collapse. So learning that, it was literally a point in time was give up, just keep doing the stuff because people thought it was kind of fun to go put clams back in the water. And every person who was my age then that would come by the dust, oh, I put myself through college working on that bay, right? And they would jump out and help and volunteer. Or find a solution, right? So I chose the path of finding solutions. I taught friends in Maryland and on Cape Cod studying the same exact thing. And this is not a unique situation. I'd like to think it's unique, but it's not. And this is nothing about the actual raw wastewater that goes into the oceans annually. This is a microcosm of a kind of decentralized network. And there's great stories here, so it's not doom and gloom. There's a whole industry is on the rise on how to solve this problem. And you know, they are entirely focused on, and it's built on competition because, you know, oh, I've got a nitrogen output of 11 milligrams per liter. Oh, no, my system's putting out 10.6. And the data being collected in this field right now and the competition for 360,000 households is pretty stiff. And that's just Suffolk County, one tiny little county sticking out into the ocean off of New York. And this problem is playing out. Florida has a million or so cesspools and septic systems that need to be replaced. I believe that's just the Biscayne Bay area. So that's, I'm really excited to talk poop with you guys because it's what we have to do. It's not the career path I chose. It chose me. I still cling to my group of seagrass scientists and are working with them on trying to research new options of how do we help carry this species through until we solve our watershed challenges. How do we? So I still got one toe in the water, but the rest of my body is up on land, and really yeah. Excited about the opportunities ahead.
So I just want to add to that. You know, Chris and I met because we both, at least to some point, live our life in sewage. I definitely do. I live there long enough to write a whole book about it. You might, you know, see it there. It has a piece of toilet paper on the cover. It's very easy to spot. But I just wanted to add to it that the problem is actually, it's really massive. And it's not just the watersheds, because even in the wastewater treatment plants, not all of them take that nitrogen out of the systems in. And it's not when municipalities want to do, or even when municipalities want to do it, the people don't want to spend money in it because they don't see the point. But the problem here is that we broke, the Mother Nature's link there. So the link is, we eat, we excrete, goes back to the soil, and the link continues. We don't do it in the industrial world. If you think about where our food comes from, especially if you live in colder climates like, in New York State, a lot of our food is grown in warmer places in California, Florida, South America. Then it's shipped to us or trucked or flown. So it extracts nutrients someplace far away out of the earth. Then we eat that food, and we put these nutrients in the body of water nearby us. And scientists call it the redistribution of nutrients on the planet, or the metabolic rift. And it's a really interesting concept, because the more of us on the planet, the more of it, we do. And we have to figure out how to close this loop again, because we're just going to deplete fields constantly someplace and put synthetic fertilizer there and dump all this nutrients into the ocean and keep killing it. So we need to fix two problems at once, and we can, because there are actually some great technologies out there. They all sort of started in 2011 when the Gates Foundation declared that Reinvent the Toilet Challenge. And it started, it wanted to create sustainable sanitation in places like Africa and India and South America, where there were basically none. And out of those efforts evolved all these great technologies that we can use here. But in order for these technologies to be loved and accepted and implemented, the people need to read about them and realize how important they are, and they're not crazy expensive. And for every situation, there's its own solution. There are solutions at the buildings levels, where there's sort of like this I would say a cartridge, but it's a huge cartridge. So it plugs in and prevents the wastewater of this building. You go to the wastewater treatment plant. It sort of treats it right there, puts it back in circulation, takes out all the biosolids, converts them to fertilizer. There are solutions that work on an individual family house level for communities that live off the grid. And there are bigger solutions that can be implemented at wastewater treatment plants too. Okay, so I'm going to stop there. I'm just going to ask my panelists some remaining questions, and then we're going to open up for questions from the audience. Fernando, why should we care about underwater caves? I'm playing, naive, ignorant, whatever you prefer. Humans are not going to live in caves again, definitely not in underwater caves. Why should we care?
So, for that, I would like to take you back into the cave for two reasons. So the first one, just imagine yourself diving in these amazing places with all of these beautiful formations that took thousands of years to grow, and that they are now telling us about the past. What was the rain in the past? How many hurricanes were in the past? Then you look back, there is a species there that you know that it is endemic to that cave. And just at one side, there is a PVC pipe coming straight from the surface, and you know what it means. Some cases, this PVC pipe will be straight into the fresh water, and it is just tools of 20% to 30% of raw sewage.
God.
In other cases, then you go out of the cave and realize that a lot of people is drinking that water untreated. So we are literally connecting our toilets into our water fountains. In other cases, they just put it into the marine water because then they will not drink it. But again, there are a lot of endemic species in these areas. And at the end, all of these are underground rivers in the coastal area, Mesoamerica. So Greece requires to have clean water. When we are adding all of these less visibility, so we have conditions that are perfect to kill the coral reefs. And with coral reefs, then we also have problems with tourism, because people also want to see a coral in our states. We have problems with fisheries, because if the coral is not healthy, the whole ecosystem is not. But then, I will go back again to the cave and tell you, like, it is not something that we are doing in the short time. But when we think about climate change, these systems are dynamic. This haloclimate is not static. So, like, one day after 1 week of rain, it was to the point that the island was flooded, we were not able to dive. The haloclimate went 5 meters deeper. So a lot of the fauna that was living in that area is something that happens, as well as hurricanes. However, with climate change, we are expecting this to happen more frequently and also heavier. Is the fauna going to be resilient enough to survive it? We don't know. But then again, we see all of this biodiversity that is giving us really interesting information about the whole evolution of the fauna in our planet. And it is even giving us information on how to make better pharmaceuticals, for example. Mm. Like, there are bacteria that have been always isolated. This was the case in a dry cave. They found this bacteria that has been isolated for millions of years. They test all the antibiotics that we know. None of them work. So there is natural resistance to antibiotics. Mm. So if we better understand how this happens, we will be able to also create new antibiotics that probably will be harder for the bacteria to create any resistance. And again, we are just starting to learn what is happening in the caves. So if we do not take care of them, because we don't care about the water, because we don't care about the fauna that is living in our planet, then we are in big problems. There is another big thing. Like, now we are doing a lot of constructions in these regions. Mm-hmm. Would you like to have your house above a cave with a 1 meter thick ceiling? Like, these places collapse. That is why we have cenotes. That's natural. Add more weight, mm-hmm. or as a road with a lot of traffic, as a train, if you build it in such a way that you know the cave is there, then the engineering is going to consider that and is going to take the engineering processes to prevent an accident. If you do not know it, there is going to be a catastrophe. We are going to have something getting into the cave, polluting the water that we need, the fauna there needs, but then also we have all the material damages and most likely human lives. But then if we even think bigger picture, all of that fresh water is there. We have beautiful jungles. That jungle is drinking the water in the aquifer. So we are not only affecting everything on the ground, but we will be also affecting everything above. The whole jungle.
A little bit about, you know, is there something humans should be doing? Of course. What do you think?
I think we can do some work to help to, you know, maintain the resilience in the marine system. No, the reason we should do this because first I want to make this clear, the resilience, inherent resilience, robustness, people interchangeably use this, mean actually the same thing. That means the ability of the system, natural ecosystem, they can maintain the regular functioning and recover during and recover from the ecological disturbance to the normal status after something affected. So, I can see a little bit beyond this. If there is a point, after that point, they lose the ability to return the normal. Recently, I just put a proposal, try to start a tipping point of the ecosystem, called multi-stressors to the marine ecosystem in the ocean. So we should care about it because once the ecosystem lose the this process gathered because we get the ecosystem service from the ocean, such as the seafood, that's about like seafood and clean water for entertainment in the coastal area and other to attract the tourists to go to the beach Anyway, that's kind of very important for us. If the system this process can delay or they lose a bit, that can directly affect humanity. So what we can do, I think, as a citizen, so we call citizen science. So we can, from each of us, we can try to reduce some, save water at home, and save energy, and reduce the air pollution, and all this can help to slow down climate change, the impact of climate change. Another is we can try our best to respect the habitat. Once you go to the beach or some other system, just try to don't leave any trash or whatever garbage to the system. We respect habitat. The one more thing I think as a citizen we can do is we can try to volunteer to help something, serve the community, clean the environment. That's all I can think we can try to do to maintain the resilience.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay, so we have 15 more minutes left to the panel, so I think I'm going to skip my questions and just open it up for people and see what questions you may have for the panelists. Okay, so they asked me to ask everybody to identify themselves and say if they're a CG member and then ask the question. Go ahead.
I'm
Kyle Buckley,
a reporter with the New York Times and an SCG member. I guess this is for Chris and Fernando. You have this very valuable information, obviously. Has there been a response that you have appreciated, or not that you've appreciated, but change in behavior or change in a government system or a wastewater system that you're like, well, this is, or is it, has it kind of been met with concern in deaf ears? And is Chris's, has there been an example for you that was a template that has worked for, not just washing it all out here?
There is more awareness of the people, and there is starting to be some awareness also in the government. Last year, actually, underwater caves were proposed to be part of the legislation to create a national park. Mm. It has not been approved, but at least it's already on the Congress. But something that I see is I work a lot with local cave divers, and these local cave divers are now learning not only about the beauty of the cave, but also like the importance of all the fauna. And it is students and more people, not only in the diving community, is realizing about the fact that there is like this huge ecosystem and the importance and vulnerability of it. So I feel like we haven't reached the point to make a change, but right now we have a big way. It is really unfortunate right now. There is a huge project to do a train in all the Yucatan Peninsula. And I say that it is unfortunate because it lacks studies. The project itself sounds great, moving more people on train, removing them from cars, etc., etc. But there are no studies. Not for the environmental impact. Mm-hmm. There are no studies for the engineering.
Mm-hmm.
But it is quite interesting that this project, that it is lacking all of these studies and all of this information, and that can have a really big impact on the ecosystem. At the same time, it is creating a lot of awareness in the community. So right now we have a lot of the local community, but also we have everyone in Mexico and now even growing internationally talking against this project. And I will say again, I am not against the project itself. I am against a big project that lacks studies, providing us information if it is viable first, mm-hmm. and hope we can make it in the very best way. I will say too that one of the big problems in the Yucatan Peninsula is that we truly do not have big cities there. Most of the people is spread. And because of that, like having a treatment system in a classic way is really hard. But then also we have a lot of small communities that are still Maya communities or very isolated. Like a lot of them will only speak Maya, for example. So like bringing something new to them, it is not always easy. It is also harder to make like any kind of public sewer system or something like that. So it's truly a question for Chris, like, how can we make like a better household treatment system, for example, that is also affordable for these people?
You had your question. So, you know, there's no silver bullet, right? So, because each geography is going to need tailored solutions. But where I do think the template exists, right, and the way that, in my previous life began momentum, and I give, a previous New York State Senator Ken LaValle some credit on this one, where he said, never come to me with just a problem. Have your solution packaged up in your problem in a way that I can sell it, right? So, you know, it took a long time to figure out solutions. And here's how it could be implemented. And then having a broad base of support underneath that so that those who have to implement or put a ballot out or bond to do something know that the public has stories as hopeful and the real data, right? And so I think that template of, you know, we made sure, and I'm gonna say we in the Long Island context, and this is something I'm trying to do across the global landscape when I work with people in coral reef regions who are literally wrestling with the same thing, that getting the business community to buy in and be an equal voice with the scientific and the civic communities and the environmental communities, having that as one unified voice, kind of speaking similar messages but from their own perspectives, is the real change agent. That's how you build the champion at the political level. And then also, you know, building the local champions at the local government level to say, okay, and we'll back that up with our own actions here so that you're not out on your own. And that template kind of works here in the States. I'm still curious as to what I'm going to find, say, in a Pacific Island nation. It might actually be easier because there's probably less government, less bureaucracy to manage through. So, but just know, building a base of support to advocate for the outcome and to not be so obsessed with the technological solutions that are going to come along the way is what I find gets the most traction. And then offsetting that, saying, well, here's what the cost you're currently paying for, right? So by not investing in these communities, these are your costs. These are your health impacts. These are your economic impacts. These are your loss of quality of life impacts, right? Those costs don't get packaged up in a way that's tangible to most officials who have to, you know, put themselves out there to make a decision to say, hey, I'm gonna create a 40-year, $8 billion plan to put decentralized systems in all over, you know, the place. So,
yeah. Lady at the end.
Tyler Palmer, USA Today. And there are 2.7 million septic tanks in Florida.
Yes.
A little bit further on her question, in Suffolk County, where you said these newer systems are competing to come up with the best nitrogen, did Suffolk County pass legislation? Is it state legislation? What's driving that in Suffolk County?
So the county health department has the authority there, and it was the sheer market that brought in new competitors. So prior to 2012 or so, the data that we were getting out of the Chesapeake region and from the Massachusetts Alternative Septic System Test Center, MassTech, out of Cape Cod, was, you know, they were shooting for what would be half the cost of a sewer connection and a 50% reduction in nitrogen load, right? So they were shooting for below 30 milligram per liter nitrogen output and a $20,000 to $30,000 price point. You know, Suffolk came in and said, our standard is 19. You have to be below 19 milligrams per liter and below $20,000. And so that brought in a few new of these on-site companies, Fuji Clean and Hydro Action, and New York State Center for Clean Water Technology was established to create non-proprietary systems. And so, you know, the private sector kind of took over, and now they're shooting for below 10, and, you know, and for below, you know, $20,000 install. So there's a bragging rights thing happening amongst the industry. And the thing that I find the best is the messaging that partnership of the business leaders and NGOs and scientists put out there and then worked with the media on getting out is now you hear it on the county's, you know, biggest health, you know, environmental and health concern, threatening your drinks to each other. And so, you know, it took 10 years, right? But, you know, that's progress to me.
I'm a question about
Approach, you know, such as we did apply to Galveston Bay, and we also we've been developing some models. As I said, I use observation and modeling both to do my research. We try to answer questions such as when, where, and what caused and how caused something. Apply to other systems. Also, the information I provide to the agencies to do a better precautious management after the disaster. So I didn't follow clearly about you.
So there are like physical systems being proposed to be like sand dunes. Gigantic sand dunes. One is proposed in Galveston as well. So I was wondering what would be the effect of such structures for the ecology in the coastal regions, as well as would they really be successful in your opinion?
So, in a side effect, I'm not clear about this, you know. I didn't follow.
I think she's asking, for instance, the ice guide. If that's the village, what is the effect on the ecology of the bay?
The major impact of Ike is the wind storm. So that's the major impact of Hurricane Ike.
So the Hurricane Harvey is the flood and the rainfall. That's a relative effect of the two different hurricanes. For Ike, I wasn't here, but for Hurricane Harvey, I was here. So I have more real experience about the impact of Hurricane Harvey. You know, after that, we start our research sampling the Bay every month over a year. We went to the Bay, sampling multiple stations, collected the data we used for the research. For Ike, at that time, I was in Alaska, I guess. I saw the news about the Ike. But the impact, we pull out the information about the wind speed and the flood. After these two hurricanes, we pull out that the information. We can see Ike, the major impact of the storm surge we designed the research. I don't know if I answered the question.
But if anyone has any more questions, yes, there's a lady over there.
My name is Paula Nosa. I guess somewhat of a broad question, but what is, you guys talked a little bit about the role of media.
The opportunities, we'll call them opportunities.
What are things that journalists can do to cover this topic and these areas more thoroughly and
real quickly from the ocean sewage pollution and its impacts, more clearly articulating and working with your local partners or whomever they might be, we could help you find some. More quickly articulating what the current costs are, what the cost of doing nothing is. And then putting that into clear perspective with what the roughly $271 billion price tag is to fix the existing infrastructure, which isn't designed to handle the next century's challenge, right? So our Johnson era engineering is not going to solve next century's challenges, right? So even those price tags are really, really low, right? And so, just putting it into perspective, the size of the challenge, what's at stake, and the opportunities that exist, right? So, I think we flush from all over the world, or we discharge raw sewage into our coastal ecosystems. And then we don't have enough drinking water up in the watershed, right? And so you're paying for a on all fronts, where there's opportunity in the future to have a more closed circular economy that better serves people, the environment, and the industries that need to work
I'm going to jump in and add to that because I spent 3 years working on that book and at least a year, if not more, working on the proposal. And then when my agent was shopping around, we ran into an interesting problem that kind of anticipated. So all of the big publishers, like the Simon & Schuster, they passed on it, not because they didn't like the topic. In fact, it's that the proposal is great. The topic is super original. The writing is great. We don't know. What they said is that we don't know how to talk about it. We don't know how to discuss it at our editorial meetings. We don't know how to talk about it to our marketing people. We don't even know what to put on the cover. And I saw this. Generally, when you talk to the municipalities, they tell you people will pay money for good drinking water. Nobody wants to pay money for shit because we kind of ignore it. We pretend that it's, we don't do it. It's like, ew, ooh, that's not a topic we want to discuss. So in whatever way we as journalists can figure out how to tell the stories to people, that rather than, causing this kind of yucky reaction, we get them in because it's part of us. It's part of our planet. Then we have, a chance of, bringing money, bringing people who want to work on it, kind of like removing the stigma, I guess. Yeah.
So what I would say is to start by the point that we actually know only a very small scratch of the species living in the planet. So like estimate says, we know 10% of it is not published, that the species that are just being described or still being described have a high risk of extinction. But at the same time, I feel like right now we are in that point that we can still make a change that will have a really big impact. If we wait longer, like we don't know how long we have. So like in terms of the protection of the species, but also of our water resources, like, there is a lot there. So, and I would say like most of the people in science, we are not people who have training to communicate this. And this is something that for me, I have seen in the last 2 years. People looking for scientific answers, not into science. And it just means that we are not doing a pre to rely on you that have all the training on how to better communicate. And believe me, like most of the people, it's more than we be talking for hours and even days about the research to be able to have it in a better way to the public.
Okay. So I guess that's the end of the panel. Thank you, everyone, who came. Thank you to our panelists. And if you have any more questions, they'll be around.